So I'm an aerospace engineer. I worked on military programs, began working on the Joint Strike Fighter program, the F-35 now. So I worked on that for 6 or 7 years. Came to work for DARPA, was working on innovative technologies and autonomy.
Welcome to Hangar X Studios, where former fighter pilot and host Jon Ramstad takes us on a journey across aerospace as it enters an historic period of innovation and transformation. Our guests include aviation experts, pilots, financiers, military leaders, and innovators of all types. Buckle up for another episode of Hangar X.
Welcome to the Hangar X podcast, where we explore everything around aviation, innovation in aerospace, and everything VTOL. And today we have Mike Hirschberg on the podcast. Mike, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. So great to be here.
Yeah, great to have you. You are the Director of Strategy for the Vertical Flight Society. It is an incredible organization, and the contributions you and the entire team have made have influenced the entire industry in such a positive way. Created innovations and collaborations and helped everybody who's in this industry solve some really hard problems and have some breakthroughs. So we're going to be talking about a number of things today around some of the innovations that are enabling some incredible advancements, some of the big challenges that still need to be overcome, and also how this is playing out around the world. There's been some big players in advanced air mobility, especially in China, and there's some really interesting things to talk about. But with that, Michael, I'd love for you to share a little bit about your background and how you came to VFS and what VFS is for somebody not familiar with it.
Sure. Well, thanks so much again for having me. It's a subject, obviously, that I love to talk about. Some deep history. The Vertical Flight Society was founded in 1943 during World War II as the American Helicopter Society. But from the very beginning, it was international. We had allied forces involved. We're a professional membership society, a technical charitable society. So we have members from industry, academia, and government agencies around the world that are working towards advancing vertical flight. And even though we had been going by AHS, American Helicopter Society, for many decades, we really were always focused on that advancement of technology for vertical flight. So in the 70s, we started going by AHS International. We went with the tilt rotor and the invention of rotorcraft, which are not helicopters but are based from the same principles. We looked at changing our name, and we looked at being the International Rotorcraft Society, but we figured if we were the IRS, nobody would have anything to do with us.
Those letters would get thrown away when you send out your newsletter.
I know. Exactly. So we did officially change the name to the Vertical Flight Society, really in recognition of the different types of vertical flight. So in addition to helicopters and drones and advanced rotorcraft like tilt rotors, there's also things like the Harrier, the Joint Strike Fighter, the F-35, and now in the last, decade or so, electric vertical takeoff and landing, or eVTOL aircraft. And one of the things that was really different was, a helicopter is very different in so many ways from a fixed-wing airplane, whether it's a, Boeing 777 or a Cessna or whatever. Helicopters are very different from airplanes. But when you get to distributed electric propulsion or distributed propulsion, which is when you have batteries or an engine or something that's driving multiple propulsors, so whether they're fans or ducted fans or propellers or rotors or whatever, you have this distributed propulsion, and you can come up with these really compelling, really interesting and innovative airplanes that can take off and land vertically. So that includes electric propulsion and battery electric, hybrid electric, hydrogen electric, as well as more shaft driven propulsion systems. So anyway, there's this huge revolution in the last, 10, 15 years, really from the incubation stage, maybe more than 10 years ago, and then really in the last half decade or so, where things have really come to, I won't say quite fruition yet, but the cusp of fruition, where there's multiple companies who are building and testing and flying large aircraft for the for the testing and the rigorous certification requirements. So I'll tell you a little bit about my background. So I'm an aerospace engineer. I worked on military programs in the 90s. I began working on the Joint Strike Fighter program, the F-35 now. The F-35B is the Marine, they call it vertical, sorry, short takeoff and vertical landing, or STOVL version,
Yeah, a friend of
which
mine, I
is.
got friends of mine flying that now. Do you know it has eight takeoff and landing modes?
I'm
One of
sure it
their
has a
biggest
lot.
training challenges they have with military pilots is what's called modal confusion, with just the complexity of that cockpit. But some fascinating things I've been learning about the F-35B.
So I was there in the early 90s, the 1995 time frame, came into the program office and trying to look at all the technologies and the lift bands, the nozzles and different things to try and make a, what is it, a 70,000 pound or whatever airplane, fighter jet take off and land with vertical capabilities. So I worked on that for 6 or 7 years. Came to work for DARPA, was working on innovative technologies and autonomy, uncrewed aircraft systems, as they're called today. Also advanced rotorcraft, advanced vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. And then in 2011, I became the executive director of the Vertical Flight Society, then American Helicopter Society. And really, we worked a lot of the advanced technologies for Future Vertical Lift, which is the Army's long-range vertical takeoff and landing rotorcraft. And then in the 2013 time frame, started looking at this crazy thing, which people were talking about, this electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft. And we've been having conferences every year since 2014. So in a few weeks, we'll be having our 12th annual Electric VTOL Symposium, which is part of an overall arching conference, which we call the Transformative Vertical Flight Meeting, that encompasses all types of vertical takeoff and landing and autonomy types of aircraft.
Now, in your role as director of strategy, what are some of your primary focuses going into this year?
So the VTOL industry in particular, the non-helicopter manned aircraft and larger aircraft have all the framework for the FAA and EASA. They have the regulations set out for how they should certify their aircraft, and now they have to make the changes to the aircraft, their development plans, to prove out to the FAA and to the certifying authorities that their aircraft can meet all these requirements. So this is where the maybe the long, boring process of dotting all the I's and crossing the T's and making sure that all the flight tests that they're doing go to prove that these aircraft are safe. And that's really the ultimate objective of everybody developing aircraft, that these are going to be safe and effective or benign maybe in the air traffic management system. So you're looking for the safe and efficient integration of the national airspace or the global airspace.
Yeah, I mean, if anybody flies a Boeing or an Airbus today, you're like, I'm flying in a safe airplane. And that level of trust
Absolutely.
is absolutely going to have to parlay into these new aircraft. So,
That's actually an interesting topic. So in 2016, when Uber came out with their Elevate white paper and this initiative, it got a little bit too much hype, and people were thinking, is this a get-rich-quick scheme? Like, I've got a drone, I can make it fly. Can I, make billions of dollars too? And it got a little bit, maybe, like I said, a little bit too much hype. And so people were hoping that eventually there might be, tens of thousands of aircraft flying, and that there'd be, large numbers of the public flying with these small aircraft. Well, normally small aircraft don't have to have the same level of safety as an airliner. Airliners are the safest means of transportation ever devised by humankind. They, almost nobody's ever killed in a, U.S. or European airline accident anymore. So trying to get these small aircraft to that same level of safety or approaching that same level of safety is hundreds of times or thousands of times safer than what you would normally require for a 5-passenger or 4-passenger aircraft. So definitely they're going to be much more safer, sorry, much safer. The system safety design is, like I said, orders of magnitude higher than what would be for a comparable sized airplane or helicopter, because the hope is that there will be safe enough that members of the public can fly just like you do in an airliner, and you don't have to worry about there being any accident or that you're not going to reach your destination safely. So it's definitely first time in history that a brand new type of aircraft has been designed and being designed to have these incredibly high levels of safety.
Yeah, so developing toward having this safe project that we can certify, a commercially certified aircraft for use for somebody who's going to operate it for profit. There's so many business cases around that. That's definitely one. And I'd love for you to expand on that as you're looking across the industry. What are some of the biggest challenges technically, different innovations, propulsion, battery, infrastructure? There's so many that probably come to mind for me. But I'd love to know what are the top biggest challenges that you guys are seeing that people are really trying to solve? They're working hard to solve them right now.
Yeah, no, I mean, I used to say there's a thousand reasons why eVTOL aircraft won't work, but we're trying to find solutions to all of them, and I think we're getting pretty close. I mean, there's still a lot of naysayers out there who really just doubt the fundamentals of electric VTOL and electric propulsion and distributed propulsion and VTOL in general. There's some people who just feel that the helicopter is, better in every single way, but some of these innovations are looking at, as I mentioned, safer, faster, potentially much quieter. If you can transition from vertical flight to wing-borne flight, you can have much more efficiencies from that. And just, introduction of a brand new level of autonomy or system safety in the cockpit. So helicopters have been well known, and it takes it takes 1.5 people to fly a helicopter. You've got to have your hands and feet all moving at the same time. There have been many improvements in helicopters and also airplanes as far as autonomy. You mentioned at the beginning about the F-35B, where there's different modes. A lot of those are all computer controlled, so that the pilot isn't actually controlling all the things. They even have an auto land feature. You just press the button and it'll come to a hover and then come to a land. So with autonomy, there's lots more levels of safety and efficiency through the air system, so that advanced aircraft can be more efficient than aircraft that were designed, decades ago.
And so what are some of the challenges there in that? Is it the flight control systems, the flight laws to provide the autonomy, to provide, I'm a commercial pilot. Me and Salim, who you both know, he's got a lot more hours than me, but I have 6,000 hours. But let's say I take a 500-hour commercial pilot and I want to put him in an eVTOL or something even longer range, like what XTI is building. You need to be able to have a transition, and the FAA came out with the SFARs talking about that transition in pilot training. But what are some of the, I guess, challenges or maybe some of the big, bright spots in the software, the flight control systems that the industry is really focused on right now?
So fly-by-wire is kind of a known thing that's been flying for 50 years in experimentation and also in airlines. I believe Airbus aircraft are generally all fly-by-wire, which just means that it's computer controlled, just like when you're driving a car, you've got general mechanical control of your steering wheel, but you've got computers that are in the loop. That may help with your ABS, your automatic braking, and then now with autonomous driving to help you stay in your lane and things like that. So with these with fly-by-wire, it's a computer that's actually controlling it, and you're telling it what to do. So the computer can make sure that you don't do anything stupid, basically, that you don't fly the aircraft into the ground or try to rip the wings off or things like that. So fly-by-wire is, like I said, it's known. The FAA has been, I'll say, a bit slow or a bit conservative in approving fly-by-wire helicopters and aircraft for business aviation and the general public. But it really is an enabler for these new configurations where you couldn't possibly, you know, if there's three different thrusters or six or eight or 12 different thrusters, you couldn't possibly control them all at the same time and have good control over it in these different modes. So the vertical takeoff, the horizontal takeoff, the transition, things like that. So computer control, fly-by-wire, and this automation will really provide huge dividends both in the efficiency and the comfort and the safety of aircraft. There's something called simplified vehicle operations that people have been looking at for the last several years, which is, again, taking away some of the stick and rudder, some of the really manual adjustments, and you are telling the aircraft computer what you wanted to do. You know, we want to fly on this heading, rather than you're actually controlling the flaps and the ailerons and the throttle settings and things like that. I'll say the FAA is, you know, looking at all these things, as well as complete autonomy. The companies like Boeing's Wisk is looking at not having a pilot on board, so you'd have a remote operator on the ground, and the aircraft in the air would be flying itself. There's a groundswell of momentum for future maybe complete autonomy in the air, so they're being controlled, operated, monitored from the ground, and there are steps towards that. I'd say that's, you know, some years still out there for these higher levels of autonomy, but certainly the computer-controlled fly-by-wire systems is a key enabler for that.
Yeah, in Bell Helicopters, fly-by-wire is quite a milestone. Any other like big achievements that stand out to you, what you're seeing?
Well, I would say the FAA has not yet approved a fly-by-wire vertical flight aircraft. So the Bell 525 Relentless will hopefully be certified this year. Also, the tilt rotor, which Bell had originally started, and now is Leonardo, the AW609 civil tilt rotor, is fly-by-wire. Hopefully, that will also see certification this year. But, you know, the FAA wants to be very conservative and prudent and make sure that all of their concerns are addressed.
Milestone, they got the airplane where it's now ready to be certified, but they've put in the work, developed the systems,
sure,
the flight control, the avionics to be able to do it. And that was a big step forward for the industry.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anything else like that standing out that's going to allow like some other breakthroughs where, hey, you know what, this could shorten my timeline to certification because of how, like, here's what I'm thinking is, you take a Joby or an Archer or something that has multiple engines, and if I'm in vertical flight or even transitional flight, my normal flight controls don't work. So I'm going to have to maybe move my engines independently to attribute to roll or yaw or a gust or, you know, certain things like that. So the flight controls are going to have to operate very differently than we've seen in any other aircraft before.
Yeah, and fly-by-wire enables that, so you don't have to worry so much about, am I in vertical flight or am I in horizontal flight as far as what the angle, the tilt angle, things like that
are. So you're trying to make it seamless for the pilot. They just know,
absolutely,
I want to stay here and come in and land in a very controlled fashion and settle down slowly. And you're telling the computer what to do, and it's then using the flight controls and the engine positioning to accomplish that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not quite on topic, but I did fly in a V-22 Osprey a dozen years ago or so. And, it's not a commercial aircraft, but they had a little window, you know, so you could see outside. And you could see the tilt angle of the nacelle. So it's a fly-by-wire aircraft. And I couldn't really tell, like, what, if we were horizontal or vertical. Like, I mean, I could sort of tell it, but it wasn't like, oh my God, we're transitioning now, right? It was very smooth. And if I didn't know that I was in any particular special aircraft, I wouldn't have been able to tell. And, you know, I don't, you know, that's 1980s technology basically. And so I don't know how germane that is to today's vertical flight aircraft. But I think that the computer controls will really be groundbreaking and enabling for this next generation of aircraft.
Now, what are some of the biggest innovations that need to happen that can help this entire industry move forward or accelerate the momentum?
Yeah, so the main thing now, I think that the biggest requirement for the companies that are the farthest ahead, that are kind of in this, I'll say final approach maybe for certification, is money. You've seen a couple of companies now in Germany, Lilium and Volocopter, where they have been going on now for many years. Volocopter first flew in 2011. And it's just a simple little two-seater, you know, aircraft that they've been trying to get certified. And the EASA, the European Union Aviation Safety Agency, placed the bar higher, or, you know, we were saying maybe too high, where it's got to be at least as safe as an airliner, or it's got to be as safe as an airline. And it's kind of silly for a two-seater or even some of the smaller ones, but that really drove up a lot of weight and complexity and redundancy. But both of those companies basically filed for, in the U.S., what you call Chapter 11 protection. So they're still in business. Lilium has found somebody to invest more money into it, which keeps them moving along in their progress. But that's really, I think, front of mind even for the, or top of mind for the U.S. companies. Like, you know, you look at the 525, the Bell Relentless and the 609, they've been saying for 5 years or more now that we think that, you know, we think that this year or next year we're going to get the certification. So they've done the design and they're ready to be certified, but still they're answering questions from the FAA, and I don't have any insights into what those things are, but it's, you know, to actually get the certification or actually be certified is, you know, you don't want to know when it's going to come. And so the companies, I think, are really trying to prove out the designs, and that's right now, that's the name of the game, I think, for 2025 and potentially in the future with all these different new designs, is actually being certified. Yeah. As far as technologies, I'll just say that, you know, batteries are very limited. We think that for the kind of short range urban air mobility missions and maybe some of the mid range missions, you know, 50 to 100 miles, that batteries can do it for some of the smaller aircraft. But as at least with today's technology, you know, you're going to need better batteries, much better batteries, a step change in batteries to get much further than that. But there is also hybrid and then hybrid propulsion using the energy and fossil fuels. And then kind of, you know, farther on the horizon is the hydrogen electric fuel cells, which we see as, you know, potentially a game changer. But again, there's a thousand reasons why it won't work, and so we're trying to figure out you know, the path that will work to actually get the certified viable business using hydrogen electric propulsion.
Well, yeah, in the when I'm thinking about propulsion, I think there's a lot of breakthroughs that can happen there. If I'm looking at pure battery, every takeoff and landing on my craft is going to be at max gross weight. And I'm going to have limited range. It could constrict me to VFR-only operations just with the FAR rules for reserves, things like that. So there's a lot of focus on hybrid. We spent years researching that ourselves. What companies do you see are really making some strides, some advancement that could really unlock more capacity and capability in what's being developed on the aircraft side?
You mean propulsion specific or companies?
Yeah, companies. Yeah, companies or technologies or ideas. I know DARPA's been working on some things, but I'd love your thoughts on hybrid propulsion.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So when battery, you know, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, when people were really looking at, I'll say eVTOL, there was this sense that, well, you could keep it small enough, you know, four passengers plus a pilot and batteries would be fine. But it's always recognized that for longer range, larger capacities, higher speeds, you would need something like hybrid electric. But there weren't many companies who had actually done that much work in there. It was some companies would just say, oh yeah, it'll be hybrid electric, and not really look at the details. Or I should say, when they first started looking at the details and it looked promising, but as they looked at, you know, second and third level of details, it got less and less promising. So batteries have, I think, it's a 20th as much energy density as fossil fuels do. So if you want to go, if you need more energy, just batteries are really a tough argument to make, particularly for vertical flight. With a hybrid system, you then have two systems, right? So you've got your engine, your turbo generator, and you've got all the battery, the buffer battery, and the electric inverters and things like that. I remember also when XTI was looking at hybrid electric systems, that putting the electric motor in the hub then blocked a lot of the fan, so you weren't getting as much airflow because they had this big, relatively big diameter motor in the middle
Yep,
of the
that's correct.
fan. So yeah, so at first blush, it looked like, hey, this is a great technology to make it all, to make the electric motors in there. But then when you actually do the, like I said, the second, third level studies, it's like, this isn't as easy as I thought it was. And I think also when in 2016, when Uber Elevate came out with this the study, it was based on a couple companies who had really done the work, companies that are out still today, you know, Joby and Wisk, that have that had already done 5 or more years of development testing. So there was sort of like, yeah, we know this can work. And then it was try to encourage other companies to come up with designs that could also work. And that really inspired a lot of people and a lot of companies. But again, I think there was a whole kind of get rich quick scheme of people not coming in from outside of aviation and not really knowing all the challenges, particularly with certification, that were required to make something that's actually a you know, viable business case.
You know, it's a good point. Any of these systems, hydrogen, turbo, electric, they're eventually going to have to be certified because I can't sell an airplane that's not certified. I don't
Absolutely.
get to sell a beta. I have to sell a certified aircraft.
Right.
It's going to be interesting to see where that goes. That's, you know, when we looked at, when we did all of our research, because we wanted to have a range of 700 miles and a payload 1,800 plus pounds, we're looking at that. We could not do it with anything we saw, either battery or even hybrid. So it's our development plan as technologies mature. And I know a lot of other players are also looking at, you know, some similar approaches. Be as green as possible as you get there, because that's important. You know, whereas we were
It is.
talking to some possible customers in Canada, that's critical. You know, if they're going to be buying new aircraft up there for use inside of Canada and globally, so very aware of that, but.
And especially like in Europe, I mean, they are very, the population is very concerned about climate change and pollution. And so I was talking to somebody from Europe this morning where companies, and this is a major airline in Europe, companies are saying, if you have a meeting that's less than 600 miles away, then you need to take a train and not fly. And it's going to take an extra day, so you need more hotel space. But anyway, it's like, you know, there are places in the world where continuing to use conventional fossil fuel is not going to be acceptable for especially some of these things. But to the XTI's case in point, yeah, I mean, what you want to do is not possible with batteries, and difficult to do even with hybrid electric propulsion.
Well, you know, what's interesting is sustainable aviation fuel, which has about a 70 to 80% less carbon footprint. You know, that qualifies under Canada's regulations as a green system. So, you know, those,
I
so
mean,
we're, that's going to be part of our platform.
And sustainable aviation fuel is a fantastic solution, and there's not really any technology involved. The only thing is they can't make it fast enough
Production.
and cheap enough. It's the capacity today, but they've proven it out in all kinds of engines, and so it's
Well, the
safe,
U.S. Navy tested it out.
especially in a blend. When it's 100% SAF, there's some question about some of the durability of the seals. But yeah, I mean, airliners today all over the world are using SAF, and hopefully the U.S. and Europe and other countries can really scale up production, because that'll have a significant impact on carbon generation.
I agree. Now, we've talked a lot about regulations in all kinds, every aspect of developing these airplanes. What are you seeing of any coordination between the FAA and ESA and other regulatory bodies? Because, you know, things that are being developed in Europe or China or here in the U.S. are going to be so, you know, cross-sold into these markets, right? Dubai is probably going to be one of the first places where a lot of these are going to be tested. They're very, you know, but what are you seeing in that area of harmonization of regulatory and certification?
Yeah, so the FAA and EASA came from very different perspectives, kind of as I alluded to before. Those two companies, Volocopter and Lilium, had these massively redundant systems with, you know, 36 or 18 different propulsors. So it was all about this massive redundancy. And then they kind of upped the game of this. It's one in a billion chance of having an accident from a failure. So they came at it for different perspectives, but the FAA obviously also wants to have things that are very, very safe. They're coming at it from different perspectives, but I won't say harmonization, but there's compatibility, okay, where if you prove that something's, if you certify something in one country, that there's pathways to have it accepted, obviously without as much work as starting from scratch, certifying it from the whole different thing. So all the companies, you know, in, I'll say, the Western Hemisphere are very much looking at this global market of, you know, North America, South America, Europe. And there's good communications and discussions and collaboration, I think, maybe even, to be able to have something where it's, you know, when the FAA comes out, well, you look at it with the EASA and vice versa, and a lot of it is the means of compliance. So you've said this is going to be 10 to the minus ninth, you know, one in a billion chance of failure. So how do you prove that? You know, means of compliance. How do you prove that to the FAA or to EASA and things like that? I think you mentioned China. The Civil Aviation Authority of China, CAAC, was the world's first authority to certificate an eVTOL aircraft. That's the EHang EH216, and that's a single seat vehicle eVTOL aircraft. It got 16 propellers. It's completely autonomous, so there's nobody on board. It's obviously monitored and guided from the ground. They actually certified it as a passenger carrying drone, which was interesting. There also are cargo versions of that. So that's significant. And they've also, China's really interesting. We knew this was coming, but I think in the last 2 or 3 months, there have been like 10 or 15 companies in China that have been flying full-scale, large passenger-carrying prototypes. So, you know, for the last 15 years, it's really been Europe and the U.S. that have been leading in development of these advanced air mobility aircraft. And from quantity, anyway, the Chinese government's putting a lot of money into different companies, drone companies, aircraft companies, universities. So you just see this explosion of different concepts in China. Countries or Western companies don't accept Chinese certification just off the bat. It had to be also validated by other authorities, whether that's FAA or Transport Canada or your...
Hey, Mike, how would you describe the differences maybe for us to understand it between maybe CAAC and how they would certify an airplane and how the FAA would? Like, what are those gaps that are there?
And I'm not an expert on regulations. I will say that the Chinese are much less transparent. So if there is an accident that happens in Western countries, you know, there's in the U.S. there's a National Transportation Safety Board. There's an investigation. You publish the you know results. You study these things. You look at how to improve it. It's all public knowledge. You don't have that in China. You don't know if anything's ever crashed. I mean, the EHang, for instance, we don't know that any aircraft has ever crashed, and maybe they haven't. So there's a transparency, and I don't know that there's any less rigor, but I would say that in general that FAA and EASA are probably more conservative than Chinese. And maybe you're looking at this one passenger aircraft, and okay, well, if it falls out of the sky, that person who got in there, that person will be hurt or killed, and maybe there's some impact on the ground. And that's very different than if you have, an airliner where hundreds of people are putting themselves in there. And the Chinese have now, I believe, certified their the COMAC, whatever it is, nine, I can't remember the AC 91 C 919, I think it is. So they have an airliner. So just a level of risk, whereas in Europe, particularly, like they don't like to have single engine helicopters because they're concerned flying over populated areas that maybe that helicopter will crash and hurt people on the ground. So I think there's a just a different mindset and philosophy between the Chinese and the Western authorities.
I wonder if the FAA looks at it almost like they do a military aircraft, because it doesn't go through an FAA certification process. It's own internal process, but it's not FAA certification for commercial sales. If I wanted to take a military airplane, even if it was a twin-engine turboprop, but it hadn't gone through certification, I'd have to start from square one if I wanted to sell that commercially. I wonder if that might be their perspective.
Maybe it's not quite the same. If you have data, if you've flown your aircraft hundreds of hours or thousands of hours or, millions of hours or whatever, that's a lot of data. And so it's no longer theoretical, numbers of how safe something is, right? You have to have the data. So the FAA really likes data. So that would help, right? So if EASA actually sorry, if EHang, for instance, said, okay, here's all the data about all of our flights, we've never had an accident, it's completely safe, then that would really help their case for a certification, either in the US or in Europe.
Well, I love that. Now, as we wrap up, Mike, put your director of strategy, that strategic hat, back on. That's right. And let's just think 2 or 3 years out, right? It's 2028, and we're looking back at the industry and the state of things. What are some things that you think we'll be talking about if we were having this conversation 3 years from now?
Sure. Well, hopefully we'll be talking about how several companies that are, like I said, in hopefully the final approach for certification today have been certified and had initial operations. So some of these companies, like Joby Archer Beta, that are looking at, this passenger transport and cargo transport. Hopefully they're all certified and have begun operations, maybe multiple flights a day, hundreds or thousands of flights a year. And people really learn from these. If you look at the iPhone came out in what, 2009, so more than 15 years ago, it wasn't really that great. I mean, compared to what we had today, it was marginally better than a BlackBerry. I mean, it did some things better and didn't even have a keyboard. So, like, how are people going to use this thing?
It reminds me of Henry Ford. Somebody said, "Why don't you pick a different color? Why don't you poll your customers?" He goes, "Well, if I polled my customers, what they would have told me is they wanted the faster horse."
Right, that's right.
Right? Because they didn't know
Yeah.
the utility and capacity of what that car was at the
Right.
time. And I think we're kind of in that same realm now.
Yeah, and we're also we can't really take advantage of new technology that comes out today for something we're trying to certify tomorrow, because you have to have the thousands of hours or the flight test, So these designs are basically tweaks to something that was designed 5 years ago, right? So it's what was that state of the art? So once you get the first one certified, you can then, I shouldn't say, in parallel with that, the company's already working on, okay, what'll be the next aircraft? Is it going to be better batteries, longer range, or is it a slightly different application, or things like that, right? So 2028, maybe we'll see some of these early 2.0, or maybe it's 1.1 or 1.2 configurations that take advantage of, improved batteries or different configurations. And again, learning from the first cases, the first use cases. Obviously, helicopters are much better today than they were when they came out 80 years ago. And the latest helicopters are even a lot more advanced than they were a few years ago. So I think we'll see some of that. I don't think we're going to see any hydrogen electric VTOL aircraft by then. Maybe some initial uses of hydrogen for conventional takeoff and landing. I know companies like ZeroAvia want to have get certified, or at least start doing some testing. I shouldn't say testing, some flights in the UK. So there's a lot of momentum towards hydrogen, but like I said, with eVTOL, there's a thousand reasons why hydrogen won't work, and it's hopefully we think that they're all solvable. But in this time, I think companies will start, I hope, will be closer to solutions and certification for hydrogen, and for that matter, for greater levels of autonomy for aircraft as well. So kind of those are the kind of the big what's next. I think we'll see battery electric, hopefully more hybrid electric configurations, and hydrogen electric. And then, of course, you know, other designs, new innovative designs, you know, like XDIs, shaft-driven lift band configuration, the Bell 525 Relentless, and the AW609 civil tilt rotor. You know, certainly hope that these will be certified and be well in, that those aircraft will be well certified and well in use by then, and well
yeah,
advanced.
We'd like to see that in 3 years, too.
Yeah, sorry, I got a little bit jumbled up. But we think these technologies will hopefully be proving themselves out.
Well, that, you know what, there'll be some exciting things to talk about. And, Mike, we'd love to have you come back on. And, you know, as you're working on some things with Vertical Flight Society and our whole community, you know, if there's issues that are coming up you'd like to talk about, we'd love to have you come back here and use this as a platform, talk about what you're doing, upcoming conferences, maybe something that comes out of this conference. They're like, hey, here's a couple things. You know, we'd like to come back on and just share with the community. So,
yeah, absolutely.
We'd love to do that.
Our website is vtol.org. So vtol.org, you know,
great
vertical takeoff and landing.
Yep.
And it's been that way since we had our first website in 1995. And it's got information on our upcoming conferences, our transformative vertical flight, our hydrogen electric symposium. And we have a big annual forum that covers everything, all the technologies from little drones to helicopters and everything else beyond.
And what's the date of the forum, the big one?
So our annual forum is in May. It's in Virginia Beach, May 22nd through the 20 through 22nd. And that's usually about 1,200 attendees, and we have about 300 presentations, technical presentations, and a lot of executives and researchers from, again, in industry, academia, and government.
Yeah, that's where I learned how to fly the F-14, Mike. So that place is near and dear to
Very
my
good.
Heart. So maybe I'll
Virginia
have to make
Beach
it out
great.
There for that one.
Yeah, that'd be wonderful. That'd be great.
All right. Well, man, thank you so much. Keep knocking them alive out there. Thanks for the work you and all the team do, and we'll talk to you soon.
Awesome. Thank you so much.